Welcome to this podcast series for the book, Deliberate Injustice, The Wrongful Conviction of Ken Wynemco, written by author Bob Hennigy, published and printed by ZG Serve, LLC, copyright Deliberate Injustice, LLC. This podcast was produced by Connie Nesberry International, LLC. For more information, visit www.deliberateinjusticethebook.com. This podcast is How the System Failed Kenny, featuring author Bob Hennigy. Bob, we've talked a lot in the last podcast about Kenny's wrongful conviction. What went wrong?
Well, I think it's quite simple. As far as the United States legal system was concerned, it's what I call the judicial perfect storm. There were four entities in the system that were complicit in this miscarriage of justice. You know, we had the police, we had the prosecutor's office, defense attorney, and the judge. Now, if one or two of these individuals just persisted in the actions that they took, you know, maybe Kenny could have survived this trial and pronounced innocent. But with all four working together, he was really a dead man walking from the beginning of his trial.
Now, really, all four were working together? Are you saying a conspiracy?
Well, I don't think it was a conspiracy because, you know, you were working together, but all four of them, their actions contributed to Kenny's demise. Let's look at all four, what they should have done. Well, take the police, for example. Their job is to protect and serve. And what better way to protect the public would be to put the right guy in jail. You know, this guy was an ogre, a monster that performed a three-hour rape and terrorized this lady for 3 hours. The defense counsel, according to the American Bar Association, the basic duty of defense counsel owes to the administration of justice and as an officer of the court is to serve as the accused's counselor and advocate with courage and devotion and to render effective quality representation. The duty of the prosecutor. The duty of the prosecution is to seek justice, not merely convict. And finally, the duty of the judge. A judge should uphold the integrity and independence of the judiciary. An independent and honorable judiciary is indispensable to justice in our society. A judge should participate in establishing, maintaining, and enforcing, and should personally observe high standards of conduct so that the integrity and the independence of the judiciary may be preserved. So you take all of these four individuals, we know what they should have done, but that's not what they did. Like I said before, Kenny could have survived one or two of these people acting as they did, but all four, he was just doomed from the very start.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with the police. What did they do that was not right?
Well, I'd like to take individual items and show how that they work together. So let's take the hiding of the exculpatory evidence. Exculpatory evidence is evidence that would help the defense counsel acquit his client. You look at who was responsible for what happened here. Number one, the police had a search warrant to search Kenny's home for items connected to the rape accusation. They took several items, they noted them all, but they also took a set of answering tapes. And on those answering tapes, his ex-girlfriend threatened to kill him, to ruin his reputation, etc., etc. Now, the fact that he hid these answering tapes from the defense greatly hindered the defense to really impeach her as a witness and to show what her true intent was, and that's to ruin Kenny. Now, during the trial, when the prosecutor was drilling Kenny in cross-examination, she asked him, plain and simple, "You keep on saying that your ex-girlfriend threatened you and threatened your life. Where is the proof?" And Kenny, on stand, under oath, in front of the defense, in front of the judge, and in front of his defense counsel, in front of everybody really, he said that there was an answering tape where her messages were recorded, where she threatened my life, threatened to ruin my reputation. It was taken by the police and hid from me and from my defense counsel. Now, at that point in time, everybody connected to this trial should have said, "Whoa, what are you talking about? Here's a guy under oath accusing the police of doing something legally improper." The defense attorney never said a word. The judge never said a word. What is this? What is he talking about, hiding exculpatory evidence? And the prosecutor paused and just ran over it. Now, Kenny's sitting on the stand. You know, I asked him, "Why didn't you press the thing?" He says, "I thought my defense attorney would do something, but as you look at this particular part of the investigation, the hiding of exculpatory evidence, all four entities were complicit in hiding this evidence. Nobody was out to seek the truth as to what was on those tapes and what could be done to impeach one of the prosecution's witness.
It's really frightening that not one of them raised the issue and said, wait a minute, we need to look into this.
It just made no sense. And, you know, I, as a layperson, am reading the trial transcript, and I'm thinking, what is everybody thinking about this? I mean, that was a pretty major accusation that Kenny threw out there. Again, to get a better picture, I remember when I was interviewing former judge Pat Cahill. He was very instrumental in some of the work for the book. And, you know, here's his take on Kenny's case. Kenny's case, when taken as a whole, is one of the most egregious miscarriages of justice I've ever seen. The whole system failed Kenny. And that's exactly what we're doing in this podcast session, showing how the whole system failed Kenny. And what better example is the hiding of exculpatory evidence that really, I think, all four entities were complicit.
Weren't they also guilty of promoting false testimony?
Yeah, suborning perjury, promoting false testimony. The police and the prosecutor orchestrated this false testimony in a meeting with the jailhouse snitch. This was all recorded in his 25-point declaration that came out during the civil suit, as we mentioned in a previous podcast. Now, seeking the truth does not warrant you take a witness, tell him to lie, and give him information from a police report so he can lie the right way. That's not seeking the truth. Again, this is an improper and illegal act that they had no problem, the police and the prosecutor, doing to affect a conviction of Kenny. It boggles the mind that they do this, and we've heard so many stories about jailhouse snitches saying whatever they can to get whatever they can out of the deal, but there's not many where the actual police and the prosecutor know he's telling a lie and promote this false testimony. The defense attorney, in his cross-examination of jailhouse snitch, there were a lot of things wrong with this guy, and like most of the cross-examinations throughout the trial, the defense, they were less than 2 minutes. There were so many things that could have been asked and could have been said as a defense attorney. He had a record a mile long, and he was basically a liar, and he was convicted on so many fraud cases, and none of this was brought up. So he was able to go on there like he was really Mother Teresa with nothing wrong with him, and the defense attorney just played right along.
Wow. Bob, weren't there problems with the victim ID, too?
I remember when I interviewed Gail Pomakoff. She was a pro bono lawyer and a very good friend of Kenny's to this day. She volunteered to be Kenny's defense attorney during the efforts to free him by submitting the DNA appeal. And one of the things she said that she was just astonished was the witness identification. Here again, present at the witness identification in the background were the prosecutor and the investigating officer. There were several officers involved in coordinating this effort for the witness identification. There was a representative from the prosecutor's office and from the police counseling the witness. Now, when there is a lineup identification, the form I believe is called Scholtel form, it's supposed to record every detail of the witness ID. The police that were recording this, again, had nothing to do with an investigation, but were part of the problem in this. All of the witnesses standing in had mustaches. In other words, the lady is going to identify who attacked her, but it was never noted in the show tell of this inconsistency of the identification. In addition, the witness had occasion to become upset, leave the witness identification area, and as the defense attorney say, she went about 40 to 50 feet away from everybody and consulted with the prosecutor's office and with a representative from the police department. Now, I don't know what was said. The witness never came forward and said, was she coaxed or anything else like that? That's not the point. The point is her leaving the witness room in the middle of identification to consult these two people and then coming back and identifying Kenny, that's just improper. And Gail was just, she couldn't believe that this happened. And again, my point is that was never noted in the show tell. So all these inconsistencies, everybody agreed to participate in keeping these out of the Scholtel information.
Bob, if it wasn't recorded in the Scholtel, how did you find out about it?
Well, what happened is, first of all, Kenny told me everybody had mustaches. You know, that wasn't the truth. But before the trial started, Kenny's defense attorney, his first defense attorney, Mr. Pepler, he requested a Wade hearing to challenge the validity of the identification. That's what a Wade hearing is. And during this Wade hearing, the stand-in defense counsel that represented Kenny to make sure everything was done properly, he noted that the victim left and he couldn't hear what was going on. He noted the five people with the mustache. He said something interesting. And again, this shows you the lengths that they went to convict Kenny with no regard for the truth. Initially, the victim, whose identification they relied on in identifying Kenny, she described the man that attacked her as 6'3", 230. Kenny was 5'10", 180. When the defense attorney got his information about the witness identification, the police gave him a report that here's a description of the perpetrator, 5'10", 180. They just doctored what she said the victim looked like. Okay. Another thing that they told him, don't worry about the people with the mustaches. She never saw his face. Now, I really don't understand. What the hell were they doing here? If she was to visually identify her attacker, when the police told the stand-in defense attorney that she never saw his face and it's okay for if the people have mustaches. It makes absolutely no sense. This is what Gail was saying. This doesn't make any sense. This whole lineup, it was almost like a sham. How can anybody identify somebody's face if they never told? And she consistently said that throughout the investigation, she never saw her attacker's face. She consistently reiterated this when asked to help with a composite.
She only saw the cleft chin, right?
Yeah, well, the cleft chin, you know, we talked about that before. That's kind of like a scar. And they just conveniently left that out of a description. I mean, they're relying on her identification, yet she said she never saw the face. And then somehow, during this whole process, she identified the guy. But what they told a defense attorney, I just think, is typical of how they conducted the investigation. You're telling him she never saw his face. You're telling him it's okay. You're telling him that she described him as 5'10", 180. I mean, look at the lengths that they went. And look at everybody cooperated. Not only the police investigators, but all the police there. The prosecutor's office. Not only the actual assistant prosecutor tried the case, but representatives from them. They all saw what was going on. I mean, nobody's blind. Nobody's stupid. This is one of the things where everybody participated. And then when in the Wade hearing, when all this came up, judge says, okay, Wade hearing is fine. It's kind of ridiculous and kind of a head scratcher, but again, the judicial perfect storm.
Wow. And nobody in the lineup had a cleft chin either, right?
Well, no, that bothersome fact of how the victim described her attacker, that was just lost in the shuffle from the very beginning. I mean, like I said, they didn't even put it in the composite. They didn't bring it up. The standing defense attorney, he never heard about it, so I mean, another thing just lost.
Bob, what did the judge in the civil suit have to say about the victim ID?
This is exactly what he said. The record includes substantial evidence of which defendants, the police, were aware when seeking the arrest warrant that defendants had reason to believe that Ms. Klug was mistaken in her identification of plaintiff at the lineup. And it's like I said before, it just didn't make any sense, this witness identification. You know, especially when they're pushing the fact that she never saw his face. Again, that's just part of the scathing indictment of what the cops and what the prosecutor did in the civil suit from an impartial judge like Judge Zadkoff.
So what else was part of this perfect storm?
Well, one of the things that I realized as I'm reading the trial transcript, I mean, the prosecutor was running roughshod over Kenny. She was destroying his reputation in front of the jury. Anything that she could bring up, whether it had anything to do with the investigation, whether it had something to do with his past that wasn't even, should have been inadmissible. I mean, she just ruined his reputation. And I'm thinking of this as I'm going through. When I ended up interviewing the juror, this really came to light. Because, as I said before, the jurors didn't believe the jailhouse snitch. He had a problem with the identification, but one of the things that he believed was that Kenny was the type of ogre that could commit this crime. And that, he said, is what he based his guilty vote on, the fact that Kenny was this guy that could commit this horrific crime. And one of the things that went a long way in convincing him of this was his ex-girlfriend testimony. I mean, it was really slanted against Kenny. And again, hiding exculpatory evidence like these answering machine tapes, I asked him, what would he think if he heard what she said on those answering machine tapes? And he said, well, that would give him great pause to really believe her. And again, hiding exculpatory evidence to prevent the defense from impeaching a witness. We talked about that. But we're talking about the destruction of Kenny's reputation, where the judge let the prosecutor go as she, the defense attorney never objected to any of the things that she implied, and I use the word implied, in front of the juror, and it convinced him. So all four, the defense, the prosecutor, and the judge, they all complicit in this. And really, as according to the juror, that is really what swayed him to vote guilty for Kenny.
And his defense attorney didn't have much time to prepare either, right?
Well, he didn't have much time to prepare, and as we noted before in a previous podcast, he had options when he was assigned on Friday and going to trial a major case. Kenny had this wonderful quote where he says, 2 days, that's not enough time to work on an OWI, and that's the truth. And we point out he was supposed to interview Kenny, put together some strategy. There was no strategy involved. He met with Kenny one time, and Kenny said half of the meeting was him telling him how good of an attorney he was. So he never consulted Kenny. He never got Kenny's opinion what could be done. Again, he didn't formulate any type of plan. We noted before that, you know, you really need to promote the theory that somebody else performed a crime. And when you use that as one of your strategies in your court, it opens up so many avenues of what you should have done. And he didn't do that. But, you know, there were two things that bothered me when I looked into this about the defense attorney. Kenny was kind of bewildered that the number of charges went from 13 to 15 to 17 to 16. It kind of went up and down. And there was always the breaking and entering and the armed robbery charge. But the number of CSC 1 or criminal sexual conduct in the first degree charges kind of went up and down. And Kenny asked his attorney this, and he turned and said, well, every time you stuck your finger in her, and he says, wait a minute, I didn't do this. Now, if that isn't some sort of implication that he believed Kenny was guilty, I mean, that really bothered Kenny, but there was nothing he could do. The worst part about this whole thing that shows where the defense attorney's priorities were is the fact that the victim, after the investigation, a couple months into the investigation, she came forward and told the police and told the prosecutor that she had an affair, an illicit affair, earlier that day. And we talked about this at great lengths in previous podcasts. Now, under the rape shield law, this is something that she didn't want to get cross-examined and embarrassed in front of her husband, who didn't know about the affair at the time, and really ruin her reputation and ruin her marriage. And that's a valid request. And the fact that the prosecutor went to the defense attorney and asked him if she could, giving this information to you about the case, which I have to do, and we'd like you not to ruin her reputation. Now, the next step, and Gail was livid with this, the next step, if you're truly representing your client, is to go to Kenny, tell him the situation, and ask him what he wants to do. He's supposed to be an advocate for Kenny. So it's up to Kenny whether they want to pursue this, and it's not the point whether Kenny would have said to do it and not to do it or bring it up or not to bring it up. The fact is he hid this from Kenny. That's not acting as his counsel. That's not acting as his advocate. You know, so you have an ineffective defense that was probably, it started with the judge's decision, so he's complicit in this by saying you got 2 days to go. It continued with the prosecutor when she knew she was at a disadvantage and that he wouldn't be able to effectively defend him. And she said nothing. And, of course, the defense attorney not only went along with it, but his actions were anything but effective. Kenny was handcuffed with someone that really didn't do a lot to defend him.
And the final clincher is that no DNA was tested.
That's another thing. During the civil case, they interviewed the initial defense attorney, Mr. Pepler, and he asked him what he thought of what happened with Kenny's real defense attorney, Albert Markowski, and what he thought of the 2 days to prepare and everything else like that. And he testified that he called him up and told him, "This is, you know, you can't let the judge run roughshod over. You got to get an extension. You got to let them know you can't do this in 2 days. And you really need to get the DNA tested. You need to get the DNA tested to prove that your client didn't do it. And the request for DNA testing was a win-win for the defense. We've said it before. Nothing that came out of the DNA testing could implicate Kenny because the ABO blood test performed on all of the evidence excluded Kenny. So arguing from the aspect of another person did it, we need to test the DNA and see if someone was present at the crime scene that we don't know about. Oddly enough, that DNA test did identify the unknown donor, and that unknown donor was eventually identified later, 5 years after Kenny's release. But it did identify someone was there, and that wasn't Kenny, and it can't be explained. So, again, that an ineffective defense. And, of course, the lack of DNA testing, everybody was responsible for it. If you're looking for the truth, let's do the DNA test. If the Michigan State Lab didn't have the facilities to properly do it, let's send it out and let's get it tested. Let's make sure we got the right guy. And if we don't have the right guy, let's find out who we're looking for. The police, the defense, the prosecutor, and the judge, all part of that whole thing. Nobody saw that it was it would have been the proper thing to have the DNA tested and really find out who the guy was that actually performed the rape. As long as it would assist them in convicting Kenny, it was okay. But if it wasn't going to assist them in convicting Kenny, it was just ignored. And that DNA, that pesky DNA test, was just one of them.
Is there anything else you want to say, Bob, to wrap this up?
Again, I call this the judicial perfect storm. All four of the entities that participated in Kenny's trial, I think were complicit in ending up with a wrongful conviction and Kenny being found guilty. We've talked about this before, Connie. In my mind, putting the wrong person in jail for 40 years, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. It was really a shame that this happened. And like I said, I think all four entities were complicit. So
yeah. Where did you get the term judicial perfect storm?
Well, I actually came up with that, and then hopefully in cases like this, people can use it in the future, because really it was the perfect storm. Kenny was, he was in trouble, like I said, from the moment he walked in. There was nobody on his side, and Kenny has this line, "I was the only one telling the truth, and I got 40 years," and that's exactly what happened.
Well, thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Connie.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. We would like to give you a 20% discount for ordering the book, Deliberate Injustice, The Wrongful Conviction of Ken Wynemco, at www.deliberateinjusticethebook.com. Use code POD20. Order today to learn more about wrongful convictions and how this can happen to anyone. Again, your discount code is POD20.